From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's big upheaval underway in the American energy industry in the last few years. Some of it you've noticed. Fracking. Dirty. Controversial. But it's produced so much natural gas, the U.S. now has a glut. Some of the energy story you may have missed. The big oil play at North Dakota's Bakken Shale Formation. A fossil fuel boom. Clean tech has taken some big hits. But green energy is plugging along, too. The president is out pushing in a big way for all of the above. America as energy powerhouse. This hour on Point, America's surprising energy makeover. You can join the conversation. Are we all drill baby drill now? Fracking, offshore, the works. What about clean tech? What about the Keystone XL pipeline? What's our new energy profile? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Juliet Alperin, national environment reporter for The Washington Post. Her big story, the clean tech meltdown, is in the February issue of Wired magazine. Juliet, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And back again with us, this time from Carbondale, Colorado, is Phil Verliger, founder of P.K. Verliger, LLC, an energy and economic consulting firm. Last time we talked, he was up in Canada's tar sands country. Now he's back in energy boom USA. Phil Verliger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Juliet, let's just listen for a moment, if we may, to some of the tone of what the president said the other night. I want to dig into all the details, but I mean, this was a kind of energy boosterism from a Democratic president we haven't heard in a long time. It's partly political. It's partly reflecting some new realities in the energy world. Here he is talking about this sort of drill baby drill offshore.
Over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration. And tonight I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources. Right now, American oil production is the highest that it's been in 8 years. That's right, 8 years.
And not just that, he's talking 600,000 new jobs from fracking, natural gas supply that can last 100 years, all kinds of biggest this, best that, most in many years. But of course, he also said, didn't talk about coal, didn't talk about nuclear, and said oil reserves won't be enough in this country. You've got to do everything.
With only 2% of the world's oil reserves, oil isn't enough. This country needs an all-out, all-of-the-above strategy that develops every available source of American energy.
Juliet, you know this world and this industry very well, you as well, Phil. But Juliet, dive in here first. What were we hearing there the other night? I mean, on the one hand, we know he's flanking the Republican contenders for the White House, who are the drill baby, drill crowd, but he sounded almost in that camp himself. What's he reflecting? What's he pointing to?
Well, I think, as you point out, he really is reflecting the new realities that we face. And so what's interesting is, you know, it's great that he takes credit for an increase in oil production. That's obviously driven by market forces more than anything else, given the high price of oil. And in fact, it's pretty smart packaging, because when he talks about, you know, the oil that he's allowing to be drilled, and in fact, they announced a new lease sale just today, that's really just reiterating a five-year plan that's been out there for quite a while and, of course, is scaled back from what George W. Bush wanted to do. So it's not like he's going all out, but he's certainly talking as if he's going all out. In terms of natural gas, that really is a place where we've seen the administration try to encourage it, despite the controversy, as you alluded to, over hydraulic fracturing, kind of the way that you can extract natural gas from shale rock. So there's no question that he's trying to push those, even as he reiterated his commitment to renewable energy, which is something he and his advisors still feel strongly about.
Phil Verliger, he's presenting the United States as or on the cusp of becoming an energy powerhouse after years when the sort of public perception and often reality was huge, addicted to oil, as George W. Bush said, kind of dependent on imports. Here's the president putting forth a new picture of this country as an energy powerhouse itself. What does that reflect, Phil?
Well, one, quick term has changed circumstances. We're now one of the major oil exporters in the world. I think we probably export more oil on net than Iran. What has happened is we've built refining capacity down in the Gulf that produces the products that Europe needs, that South America needs, and others. At the same time, the development of shale gas, which he claimed in the message was funded by the government, but really was led almost entirely by the private sector and not by the big oil companies, by small people like George Mitchell, has given us a competitive advantage in energy that is scaring the Chinese to death and scaring everybody else to death, because in the United States now, natural gas maybe costs $15 to $18 per barrel for oil, whereas those every other country is paying $10, $12, $14 per 1,000 cubic feet, paying oil price equivalent. So we have a 50, 70% cost advantage. And a lot of manufacturing is starting to move back. Petrochemicals are coming back. Steel's going. People are talking about building various kinds of smaller steel mills. You know, the discovery of shale gas is changing not just the energy sector, but the whole manufacturing sector, and putting us on a huge competitive advantage with the countries that we've been fighting with for market share for the last 20 years. So he's exactly right. I mean, in the next 10 years, the whole landscape is going to change.
I'm reading here from the Financial Times. This is last week. U.S. natural gas prices have slid to their lowest point in a decade. Industry braced for further declines as the shale rock drilling boom redraws America's energy landscape. The price collapse, they're calling it. Natural gas prices down 85% from an all-time high in 2005, benefiting heavy industry in the U.S., as you say. That's a lot of gas coming on stream to drive prices down that far, Phil.
Yeah, it's just... what's happened is we solved the shale gas issue, and other countries have shale gas, but we really are way out in front the way other countries were with oil and things like that years ago. So we now have this advantage, and we have huge gas reserves on this basis. And as the president said in the message, we need to solve the problem, make sure the fracking doesn't lead to degradation of the water and cause other problems. But those problems, there's people, various academic institutions that have come up with solutions to essentially solve those problems. So we're moving ahead. It is just, it's stunning. I was in the Carter administration, and Jim Schlesinger, the Secretary of Energy, convinced the president that by 2000 we wouldn't be producing any natural gas at all. So, I mean, it is just a sea change. And to see it happen and to see prices come down this way is just turning everything. And if you go back, I lived in Cambridge and in Carlisle and in...
Around Boston,
Wellesley around Boston, we had heating oil in some of the areas. Heating oil used to be a big business. Now, anybody who can switch from heating oil to natural gas will do it. As a New York Times article pointed out, I think it was last Saturday or Sunday, that the homes that are not on the natural gas lines, or homeowners, are seeing much higher heating costs, $500, $700, $800 a season.
On the oil side, natural gas going way down. Juliet, I want to come to you on the meltdown in clean tech and look at if there's a relationship between this up gas, down clean tech. But Phil, first to you on the offshore part. We just heard the president say at the top of the hour, I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources. This has been a point of contention for so long, at least in political rhetoric, and more than that, how much of our offshore oil will tap. Is this a big thing he's describing here? Is it like, damn the torpedoes, drill everywhere offshore, even after what we saw in the Gulf a couple years ago?
Well, I think Juliet got that one exactly right. I mean, I heard that, and I said, no, so, we've been doing that. Opening it up means that you first have to go through environmental impact statements and everything else, and then get people to nominate properties and so on. That's, even if they really did that, you would see almost no impact through, say, 2016, 2018. That is not a big deal.
But, Juliet, 2016 is not so far away in energy terms. We're talking about the U.S. exporting, being an oil exporter here. That's partly in the basis already of what's coming out of the Gulf.
Right, although a lot of that has to do with refining capacity, because we still import the majority of our oil. And
sure.
In fact, one thing that's very interesting is that the same five countries that we imported from a decade ago are still the top five countries that we imported, which includes,
let's not get carried away with all this boomtown talk. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, again, as there are significant fines both, you know, in North Dakota, as you alluded to, as well as, you know, clearly there are fines in Canada, which has sparked a real debate about to what extent are we going to import carbon-intensive oil from Canada. And one thing that's so interesting is that for all of the oil boosterism that President Obama was touting in his State of the Union speech, he didn't mention the fact that he nixed a controversial oil pipeline just the week before the Keystone XL extension. So he's very deft at kind of, you know, touting what he wants and then maybe not mentioning some of the things that might anger folks in the oil industry.
But Phil, on the other side of the ledger, we're now reading that the U.S. could be down to importing maybe just a third of its oil, I don't know, in a decade or so. Is that realistic?
Well, it could be, although Juliet's right. But, you know, yes, we're exporting petroleum products. Yes, we're importing crude oil. But the fact of the matter is the people in the world, most consumers in the world don't want crude oil. They want gasoline in their car. And so they need the products. And we are becoming the center of the place to refine. Europe has just seen a major company shut down 600,000 barrels a day of refining capacity, and we're shutting down a lot on the East Coast. The oil has to come here to be refined. We have the refineries that produce the ultra-low sulfur diesel that they demand in Europe, that people want in South America and so on. Nobody else has got those.
We're going to look in this hour at oil and at gas and at fracking offshore and then all the green energy situation, where that stands when the president says all of the above. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's big energy makeover, where a fossil fuels power again, but still struggling with green energy. Phil Verliger is with us from Carbondale, Colorado, and Juliet Alperin, national environment reporter for The Washington Post, with her big story in Wired magazine this month, The Clean Tech Meltdown. Here's the president talking gas, natural gas, and behind that, fracking in his State of the Union address.
We have a supply of natural gas that can last America nearly 100 years. And my administration will take every possible action to safely develop this energy. The experts believe this will support more than 600,000 jobs by the end of the decade. And I'm requiring all companies that drill for gas on public lands to disclose the chemicals they use. Because America will develop this resource without putting the health and safety of our citizens at risk.
A short sentence, but a big one. Juliet Alperin, I mean, you cover the environment and a lot of energy. The president says, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to go, you know, gung-ho on this without putting the health and safety of our citizens at risk. Some people may have had a little cognitive dissonance at that point, given all the controversy around fracking. He seems to be throwing his arms around it big time with those caveats. Do the caveats and the embrace work together, Juliet?
Right. It's a complicated question. Clearly, there are a number of people who are concerned about, you know, the chemicals that haven't been fully disclosed that are used to extract this natural gas. And one of the interesting things, while he's highlighting the fact that the Interior Department will demand disclosure on public lands, the vast majority of this activity is happening on private lands. And it's happening really in people's backyards, near their schools, things like that. That's one of the reasons it's been so controversial. Energy extraction often is concentrated in places that aren't directly where people live. And one of the reasons why fracking has become this lightning rod is because it really is pitting neighbor against neighbor and in people's individual communities.
Phil, where are we in the fracking boom? I mean, it's huge already. Are we just at the beginning? Are we deep into it? He talks about 100 years worth of natural gas. At what level? Where are we in the arc of this thing, Phil?
Unfortunately, there aren't facts about the future. I'm not sure. If you looked 5 years ago, you would have said that natural gas was going to be trading at prices five times as high as they are now, and production would be about 15% lower.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, if prices remain at these levels, the increase in production will slow. It may even go down a little bit because these gas wells tend to production from them starts at a high level and then declines over time. My guess is, though, that we're going to see more and more additions to supply, because the success of this industry is one where they manage to push down costs, and they've been doing this for 40 years, 50 years, and they tend to find new technologies that increase their ability. And I think that they'll solve, they'll come up with cleaner, better fluids over time. The oil industry always and the gas industry always has to be dragged kicking and screaming into improving the environment. But once they do it, and once they realize they have to do it, they're smart engineers and they're smart scientists, and they solve that problem. So I think we'll see more gas, a substantial increase in gas production, as market circumstances dictate. Our problem right now is creating demand for it. We have no demand. Cheniere is now talking about building a number of plants to export natural gas to Asia. I mean, it's mind-boggling for somebody who's been following this industry for 40 years.
It sure is. Talk about a change.
When I was a graduate student in Massachusetts, we couldn't get natural gas because price regulations had less meant the gas stayed in Louisiana and so on. People wouldn't sell it to Massachusetts.
But you're saying this dovetails right into the big manufacturing theme in the president's speech the other night, that this makes American manufacturing, if it gets up on the rails, very competitive to have such a cheap local energy source.
Oh, it's enormous. And it's interesting that the programs to export natural gas, the manufacturers are saying, hey, don't go too fast, because we now have an enormous competitive advantage. And it's going to take us 10 years to take full advantage of this. But a lot of the unemployed, people who can't find work were working in construction and nobody's building. Well, 5 years, 6 years down the road, 10 years down the road, there are going to be manufacturing jobs that are tied to energy that will pay pretty well.
This is wild.
I mean, this is a game changer.
Yeah. There's a kind of old picture of what we are, energy and manufacturing-wise, dissolving in a way before our eyes. You pinch yourself. It's kind of hard to believe, but maybe it is. You've said, Phil, that we're kind of blundering into energy independence at some point.
Yeah, I was just a young guy when Richard Nixon in 1973 talked about pursuing energy independence, and I'm now I'm outlining and working on a book. We're moving towards energy independence, but I think by the 50th anniversary of his speech on energy independence, we will be independent. We will we'll still be importing crude oil from Saudi Arabia because they built a big refinery in the United States, but we won't have to. The net, we won't be. And it's all everybody said, well, gee, we should plan this thing ahead. It's all almost by accident and serendipitous, but we are moving. The whole situation is changing. And if you, I don't want to sound like a Republican, but it's entrepreneurialism and people saying, well, maybe we can do something differently. Maybe we can apply technology and so on, and the clean energy. It's just kind of beginning to come together by luck.
Of course, whenever there's a boom, a lot of the cost behind the boom can be overlooked for a little while. I want to bring that to you, Juliet. A couple of callers here first. Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. Thanks.
Hi.
Yes, for 25 years ago, I talked to an oil driller. They said it cost between $40,000 to $80,000 to drill a well, depending on whether it's just gas or gas and oil. Now, for $40,000, you can put a lot of solar and wind equipment up, and you're not dealing with a dry hole. It's going to work when the sun's shining and when the wind's blowing.
So think about where you put your money and where you're investing. Terry, let me hold that one for a minute. Katie in Iowa City. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My concern with this is that, in our drive to gain independence, we kind of lose sight of the overall future effect of some of these places, with the BP. But, I think of the towns where we've already destroyed a good deal of the town and the waters. We've got lead poison waters in the Midwest just from our drive for lead minerals. And we've got, the Pennsylvania town where the coal is still burning to this day, and that kind of stuff worries me. And I think we need to really think about that before we go after these energies.
The cost of what we're going after here, it's exciting. Manufacturing may be lining up to capitalize on it, but let's look at the cost as well. Juliet, let me play just a little bit here. I mean, Obama spoke to that as well, the president, in the State of the Union address, saying, look, he really means all of the above, not just these fossil fuels, but the other side of the ledger. Here he is.
I will not cede the wind or solar or battery industry to China or Germany because we refuse to make the same commitment here. We've subsidized oil companies for a century. That's long enough. It's time to end the taxpayer giveaways to an industry that rarely has been more profitable and double down on a clean energy industry that never has been more promising. Pass clean energy tax credits. Create these jobs.
Okay, Juliet, there he is, you know, full rhetorical flight saying right. All of the above and talking about all this clean stuff and nobody's going to do better than us. But you're writing, clean tech meltdown in Wired magazine at the same time as he's praising all kinds of new fossil fuel advances. What's going on? Is it one or the other? Are we losing one? Are we just going back to fossil fuels? What's happening?
Well, these energies do compete against each other. And one thing that's very telling of, you know, what we were just listening mm-hmm. to is that Obama is asking Congress to, for example, extend a critical production credit for wind power, which is going to expire at the end of this year, which is very uncertain. He's asking them to end the subsidies for fossil fuels, which still get many more subsidies than clean energy when you tally it all up. But at the same time, Congress hasn't shown much willingness to do that, particularly with Republicans in control of the House. And, you know, so for example, if you're a wind manufacturer, you know, it's very interesting to hear Katie and Terry's thoughts. And I think a lot of Americans are raising these questions about, look, you could lock in wind energy at the same price for 20 years, know that it doesn't have some of the same consequences as natural gas. But if you're not going to, say, put a price on carbon and you're not going to factor in some of those environmental consequences, it's still cheaper to build a natural gas plant in many cases. And so, you know, it is an energy marketplace. And to some extent, you know, when you put in more natural gas plants, there's less of an incentive to expand your wind and solar production. So there still is going to be some of that, but they do face challenges. And that's what I really explored in the piece.
I want to look at that, but give us the context here of the president's speech on that clean tech side, Juliet. I mean, you describe a tremendous boom in the last decade or a half dozen years in venture capital investment and government investment in clean technology. You're now describing that as a meltdown kind of bust scenario. What happened there?
So what you saw happen is initially a real interest on the part of, for example, venture capitalists who had mastered the internet, had shown that they could really transform and dominate a marketplace, put their money in, particularly starting in, you know, 2005, 2006, they started flocking to the clean energy sector and really bumped up their spending in a real way, went from hundreds of millions to billions within mm-hmm. a matter of years. And so that really started kicking things off. And for example, you saw wind capacity in this country nearly quadrupled just between 2006 and 2010.
And you had venture capitalist John Doerr, the big VC guy, you know, talking about the largest economic opportunity of the 21st century and a moral imperative, curbing climate change with all the clean tech.
Absolutely. He talked passionately about how this was an opportunity for fellow venture capitalists, but also something that they should do as a moral good that basically he choked up in tears when talking at a TED conference several years ago, saying how could he look his daughter in the face who said, isn't it your generation that bears responsibility for climate change? And so you saw this real enthusiasm. He brought on, for example, Al Gore as mm-hmm. one of his investors. And you saw a whole range of venture capitalists who got into the space. Now, they really got hammered in the 2008 recession, and you saw a dip in their investment. At that point, you had the Obama administration come in 2009, put a huge amount of money into the space through the stimulus package, and that did bump up the investment we saw. So, you know, one of the really interesting things when people just look at we've been, you know, battling with China about who's putting more money into clean tech, mm-hmm. and it's waxed and waned in part because the administration has put so much money into it, but this money is grinding to a halt, both because of, you know, ongoing difficulties as well as controversy over the failed solar maker Solyndra that, you know, lost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. And so we're just at a moment right now where even though you have seen a huge commitment by both the Obama administration and Silicon Valley, people are reassessing this in light of all these broader market factors.
Are we in an either-or situation here? This fossil fuel, you know, sort of boomtown attitude, even in the State of the Union address on the one side, does that necessarily mean that green tech, clean tech grinds to a halt? Can we have both?
We can't have both, and I definitely think green tech isn't dead. I think there are particular areas where you could see expansion. One of the most interesting things is you're seeing a lot of basically solar projects that are on the same scale as a power plant that are getting up and running. This is happening particularly in the Southwest, but you know, first it came with federal government aid, but now just on their own, they're finding enough interest in doing that. Also, tons of people, whether you're talking about in New England or Arizona or California, are putting solar panels on their home. This has become a really affordable option for people facing high energy prices. And that's one of the areas where we could see real serious expansion just because of not actually a technological innovation, but a business innovation that people figured out you could lease solar panels over 15, 20 years and make it much more affordable than asking people, hey, do you happen to have $25,000, $30,000, you know, upfront to put solar panels on your
home? Of course, there's that innovation, but there's also China pouring a lot into it and taking over that market up for manufacturing solar panels in a very short period of time. We're looking at America's big energy makeover. Let's get a call from Dave in Stowe, Massachusetts. Dave, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is a critical discussion, and I've spoken on to you before about it a few times. Your screener was talking to me, and I heard mention, but I did not hear what where the discussion was going. But my major concern, I'm pretty distressed about all this, in that the focus, there's several areas, but the main thing is that global warming is such a major issue. The Republicans have dissed it completely, and we've had this big campaign to make it not real, and yet all scientists of any creed, 99.9% of them say it's real and it's a problem.
Just look at the North Pole.
Exactly. And obviously natural gas is better than coal. There's the fracking and the pollution issue, and I'm sure we haven't got the whole story on that. But the point is that any bit of fuel you pull out of the ground that was embedded in the ground is perfectly sequestered carbon. When you pull that up and throw it in the loop, it causes the acidification of the oceans. It causes the heating up of the atmosphere. It's just a phenomenal thing that we've been overlooking for so long.
So what were you thinking the other night as the president was, you know, going full rah-rah on all of the above, including fossil fuels, Dave?
Well, you know, I'm thinking that fossil fuels are much more limited than we've been told. What's very interesting is I don't know where the 100-year estimate for natural gas comes from and the shale gas, but I know the 250-year estimate for coal takes a snapshot today. I read this in a book about this because I found it very interesting. Takes a snapshot of our usage at the moment and our known reserves. Well, our usage is going up, you know, radically. And we've actually, one of the other things I read in the book is, and I'm going to use coal as an example, we have been mining more coal, but we're getting the exact same energy value out of it recently because we're mining less quality coal. I don't know.
Hey, Dave, our time is short before the break. Let me take, if I may, your big point to Juliet. Juliet, if we got all this fossil fuel, and Phil's pointing out it could really power up manufacturing, we really need jobs. But what about the climate change, global warming factor in that scenario?
Right. There's no question, you know, while there are debates about, for example, is natural gas half as polluting as coal when it comes to climate change, or is it a little more than that? It's still a fossil fuel. And so when you lock in that infrastructure, you are locking in greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change. And I think that's, you know, the Obama administration is trying to navigate a very tight line there, particularly with their environmental supporters. And I think what you're hearing is a lot of people saying, really, when we're looking long term, how much room do we have? And do we really need to put more of an effort and more of an investment now in clean energy so that we can curb dangerous climate change?
Phil, we just got a couple seconds before the break. The president did not go into coal, not cheering for that. But with all the fossil fuel talk, are we throwing in the towel on climate change or not, Phil?
Well, I went through the State of the Union looking for the word climate change and didn't see it.
Yeah.
And I think that's given what the president said in 2009 at the beginning, it says a lot about the economic circumstances. Climate change is a luxury, and with the recession, we've had to put it aside for a while.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's big energy makeover. You heard it in the State of the Union address the other night, the way it's all being presented and some of the facts behind that presentation. We are a fossil fuels power again, says the president. We're still struggling with green energy. He's saying all of the above. And the complexion, the profile here is really changing, perhaps faster than our perception of what's going on out there. Phil Verliger is with us from Carbondale, Colorado. Spent a lot of time right in the middle of the energy equation for this country. Founder of PK Verliger, LLC. Juliet Alperin is with us, national environment reporter for The Washington Post. Her big story in this month's issue of Wired magazine, or February's, I should say, is the clean tech meltdown. She's also author of Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Ooh, a woman of parts, that Juliet Alperin. Juliet, Phil, we got lots of comment here online. Roy in Boise, Idaho, I guess, says North America is in the grip of large private interests that are hell-bent on stymieing advancement of from the oil age into the age of sustainable energy. The U.S. will be a follower in this transition, not a leader. Here, Charles writes, fracking will in the long run be the most damaging, costly energy boondoggle in our nation's history. A lot of skepticism along those lines. Let's go to our phones. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm in Gasland here in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to make the comment that our regulatory system and our environmental policies have not been able to keep pace with gas development in western Pennsylvania. We are just starting to understand some of the environmental impacts. Our township councils and local governments are struggling to regulate this stuff, yet it's happening very, very quickly.
So when the president the other night, Rob, when he said, look, we're going to be huge in gas, and it's going to come from fracking, but we're going to do it safely, what were you thinking?
That those are hollow words, given that this has been going on for 5 years. I saw the Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma license plates in the parking lot at the airport 5 years ago. It's already on. The government is late on this. We are so late.
Rob, I appreciate your call right from Gasland. As you say, Phil Verliger, what about it? I mean, it's going like crazy. It may slow down. I mean, we've got announcements even today, Conoco saying it's going to pull back from some of this fracking because gas now so abundant that gas prices have gone low. Is there a chance the president can make good on his words and be sure that what goes ahead is safe, Phil?
Yes.
How?
One is mandating disclosure of the content. Two, the EPA is doing a set of studies on this. Frankly, the Bush administration delayed it. Cheney managed to essentially, I don't recall the details, maybe Juliet does, make it very difficult, essentially make it impossible for EPA to push to find out what's going on under the Clean Water Act.
Mm-hmm.
He was representing Halliburton, not the United States, when he did that, even though he was vice president. I've watched, you watch the development of clean products for gasoline, the cleaner and cleaner gasoline and other things. I think we'll catch up. An awful lot of damage has been done, and it's terrible. You drive across Wyoming and you see all the damage done by the water pollution. But we're beginning to catch up, and one of the things that happens is the public really does want something done. New York won't move ahead until they can clean up, as I understand, until they get a better handle on how this is going to affect the water tables and so on. So, democracy works, although slowly. If I can, I'd like to point out one other thing on this
mm-hmm.
clean thing. We've missed, one of the big events in the whole in our energy history came last July when the auto industry came together with the president and agreed to go to 52 miles a gallon. So listening to the previous callers talk about how we haven't thought so much about global warming, that for the first time ever, everybody got together and said, look, we're going to save, I think it's $1.7 trillion spending on oil because we're going to move to a 52 miles a gallon car. And at the recent Detroit Auto Show, where you used to have automakers talk about fighting fuel economy, they were all now embracing fuel economy, and the auto industry finally got the message that you can't trust the oil industry, and they're moving ahead aggressively. So you know, it's not just the State of the Union message, but I mean, there is a program that's going to move toward off oil, cut oil use down, and there is the president's proposing a tax credit today, I think, to reduce that to promote natural gas in trucks, which is a great idea because that reduces pollution, that reduces emissions. You know, the dilemma we face is, yes, we have global warming. Yes, we want to cut emissions. But most importantly, we have to keep the economy growing because otherwise you wind up with situations such as we've seen in the Middle East with just total unrest and you lose control.
Well, I mean, we hear everything you're saying. Things are really moving here. But when you say most importantly, people factor that on different timescales. And you can get an argument there. Juliet, do you have the same confidence that I mean, we've seen fracking just go like gangbusters and, you know, just sprawl out all over the place. It's put all this gas and brought the price way down. Do you think that clean fracking can be figured out and catch up with the volume of it that's going on? Give us a net gain on this front, Juliet?
I think right now it's just very hard to get that answer. As Phil mentions, EPA is conducting these studies, and we're all going to be very curious to see what comes. And he was exactly right. It was I reported on this back about half a dozen years ago for the Post that Dick Cheney did insert a provision that exempted the kind of disclosure that you normally would have for this activity, specifically aimed at hydraulic fracturing. And so, you know, right now there's this, as Rob is pointing out, it's state by state they're trying to sort this out, and usually these are really issues of national importance that you would have the Environmental Protection Agency police. And so I think we may get greater clarity. But the interesting thing is right now we don't have that answer, but there are these enormous economic pressures to exploit this resource as much as possible. So that's a real tension that I think we're seeing right now.
Let's get a call from Brooklyn in New York City. Eric is calling. Hi, Eric. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My name is Eric Weltman. I work with an organization called Food and Water Watch. Mm-hmm. And our contention is that the industry is extraordinarily exaggerating the so-called benefits of fracking. For example, the number of jobs that would be created here in New York, Governor Cuomo likewise has exaggerated the job creation. It seems that President Obama has done so as well. We know that there's evidence that fracking might be worse for climate change than even burning coal. And as far as promoting energy independence, Food and Water Watch has documented that this is natural gas being produced for export. Food and Water Watch maintains that fracking is inherently dangerous and should be banned both in New York and nationwide.
Eric, your point fully taken there. But what about when you hear Phil Berliger look to what may happen with manufacturing as this cheap, much cheaper, down 85% the price, comes on stream here, manufacturing catches up. What about the potential economic boom for this country? Is it worth it or not?
Ultimately, there are safer alternatives to natural gas, but there are no alternatives to water. There are safer alternatives to natural gas, but there are no alternatives to water. And Food and Water Watch maintains that a green, sustainable economy has no room for fracking. We can't sacrifice our water, our food, our air for basically corporate profits.
Eric, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Brooklyn very much. Thanks for calling in there. Let me get one more right here. Barbara calling from Boston. Barbara Cates Garnick, this is Undersecretary for Energy in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Barbara, thanks for calling.
Delighted and happy to give our perspective. Massachusetts is a state that's very energy poor. We send 80% of our $22 billion spent on energy out of state. So I raise the question to our panelists, what if we had made the correct decisions 20 years ago, where would we be today on our energy mix? And I just want you to know that under the Patrick administration, we have really unleashed the value of energy efficiency. We've unleashed the value of renewable energy. We've made tremendous progress in this entire area. Just as a fact, since 2007, we've got 120 megawatts of wind and solar in the state's energy mix, enough electricity to power 25,000 households.
So, Barbara, let me ask you, if I may, then. You're from a state that's energy poor. So when you hear the president in the State of the Union address talking about this country as energy rich, are you happy to hear that? Is he on the right beam to you?
Yes, because he's talking about a broad spectrum of resources. And I think what he captured in that speech is that, yes, we have to use all the resources that we have available. But states like Massachusetts, which don't have traditional energy mm-hmm. resources, have to truly look to the future. And it's a process. Sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's painful, but you've got to work with your stakeholders, and that's what we've done in Massachusetts. Our success in energy efficiency is just enormous. Utilities, all stakeholders, have brought into the fact that energy efficiency is our first fuel. So yep. the governor and the president are on the same track.
There's the efficiency argument. The president brought that up as well. It's easy to get lost in the hubba-hubba over the, you know, let's drill. Barbara Kate-Skarnick, Undersecretary for Energy, thank you for calling. I mean, Juliet Opperin, there's the notion that the president pushed very hard, all of the above. And Barbara says a broad spectrum of resources to be brought to bear here. But you're writing about meltdown in clean tech at the same time as we're seeing boom time in fossil fuels. And I guess I want to come back to this once more, Juliet. Do you see avenues for green energy to move effectively forward if we've got prices coming down like crazy on this in this fossil fuel boom, on the gas side anyway?
I think there are avenues, but I think a lot of it actually depends on state and federal policy. You know, Massachusetts and the Patrick administration, for whatever you think, you know, has put its money where its mouth is and, for example, has put in requirements for utilities to get renewable energy. That is something we don't have on the federal level. So, for example, when I look across the country and look at where are you seeing an expansion of wind and solar, particularly on the scale of, say, power plants, mm-hmm. it's in states that have requirements that that energy come. Now, you know, President Obama in his speech did talk about the idea of a clean energy standard, but it's important to note that not only has Congress not passed that, but when the administration defines it, they put natural gas in that requirement. When you look at a state like Massachusetts, they're talking about renewables, solar, wind, things like that. You know, so I think that there are these avenues. I think for the fact that we have cheap solar panels, even though they come from China, are allowing, for example, a scaling up of this industry. I think you have to divide out. We might have deployment of clean energy, but when you look at clean energy manufacturing in this country, it faces a number of challenges, and it'll take either major technological breakthroughs, which we may have in certain areas of solar, for example, or, you know, just betting on policy by different policymakers to make this happen.
I was just going to pick up with what Juliet was saying. Out here in Colorado, we have the same kind of standards as Massachusetts does. And, you know, we require our utilities to use the clean energy, the renewables, and natural gas is not included. I live on the western side of the Rocky Mountains, and, mm-hmm. and there's doing a lot of gas drilling, which is causing problems. But we do an awful lot of solar generation because we have 300 days of clean of
sunshine
a year.
Mm-hmm.
A year. We've got a program here where I buy my solar power from a solar farm, which produces solar much more efficient panels than you can put on your roof. And it is, you know, so every state's moving ahead, and this is a way. Now, Barbara, who I've known for years, raised one issue. You know, what would have happened if we'd done this 20 years ago? When the Carter administration pushed through a number of conservation measures, they almost all died, retrofitting in homes and so on, insulating, with the Reagan administration and then the first Bush administration, the Clinton administration. We lost 30 years on the conservation front.
Are we going to do that again if as fossil fuel prices come down, gas prices come down, Phil?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the things that you can see, I mean, one of the pieces of data I look at is consumption of gasoline as put out by Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Mm-hmm.
People can really count it. And you can just see gasoline consumption collapsing. Consumers bought roughly 20% less gasoline in December or November than they would have had the trends from, say, 1990 through 2005.
Maybe because they're broke. When the economy comes back, maybe they boom again.
No, they're buying new, more efficient. As the economy's picked up, the conservation has expanded. They're buying more efficient cars. They learned a lesson that you can't trust big oil and anybody about oil prices in 2008, and they're responding. And also the auto industry learned the lesson. I mean, if you talk to the people at GM who used to resist fuel economy, they've seen their pensions go down. They now are moving as fast as away from oil as they can as for efficiency. And I think the lesson, when I give talks, mm-hmm. the lesson these people have picked up in the energy consumption and so on is follow the Steve Jobs model, follow the Apple model, look to consumers and look to try to involve the consumers and move them ahead. and it's moving towards conservation. And so there has been a sea change. We're only beginning to see it in the numbers, but there's an enormous sea change, and we're not going to go back. It is, you know, if you burn twice, you don't want to be burned a third time. And so people, on the one hand, on the consumer side, they're moving ahead. We'd move faster with wind power if we could get the electric utilities to build the transmission lines. That's a big bottleneck.
Still big questions. We'll look at those. Juliet, two things quickly. Just got a minute here. But nukes, not a peep from the president on nuclear power. And what about the Keystone XL pipeline? He has said no to that so far. How does that factor in here?
So, yeah, real quickly, when we saw the accident, of course, last year in Fukushima in Japan, that really did shift public sentiment in the United States, made people more skeptical of nuclear power. Also, it's just extremely expensive up front. And again, if you don't have a price on carbon, the economics don't really make sense for building new nuclear power plants. So that's why you saw the president really not mention it at all. And then in terms of the Keystone pipeline, this, I think, will be a major issue in the presidential election, no matter who's nominated on the Republican side. All the Republican presidential candidates say that this is important and is going to create a lot of jobs. And the administration so far has said we are worried about both the immediate environmental effects, about a spill along its route, as well as its contribution to climate change. So I think there you will see a broader debate about where, you know, what kind of infrastructure should we lock in and what is our energy future.
Phil, it's more than we can get to entirely, but does the U.S. stay the big refining power you described without the Keystone XL pipeline?
Absolutely. The Keystone Pipeline, there's a wonderful piece in the Washington Post on January 18th. The pipeline's irrelevant. It's a way to transfer some money to some Canadian producers and it's to U.S. refiners by creating a bigger glut of crude in the Midwest. The pipeline, you know, Mike Levy got it right. The pipeline, why we're wasting all our energy talking about this almost irrelevant issue is utterly beyond me.
Well, the president has stepped right past it, but talking all kinds of energy, all of the above, he says. Phil Verlinger, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today, Phil.
Thank you.
Juliet Alpern, author of Demon Fish, an environment reporter for The Washington Post. You're terrific, Juliet. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.